Since the attack on the Capitol, extremist movements have been suffering from just pure chaos. They've been deplatformed. They've been universally condemned. And they're finally starting to realize that, hey, maybe attacking the U.S. Capitol wasn't such a great idea after all. But more intensely, the national security apparatus of the United States is now paying them a good, hard look. At the time of recording, dozens of people have been arrested by federal investigators already and are facing charges for their role in attacking the U.S. Capitol. Be sure to listen to part one of this series featuring a conversation with Michael Edison Hayden of the Southern Poverty Law Center. That's going to get you up to speed before you listen to this episode. For 4 years, these individuals have claimed to be at war with a deep state that largely was unconcerned with them. But soon, very soon, they're going to learn what the real deep state is, and they're going to learn it the hard way. Joining me now to talk about that fallout and everything that's happened since the attack on the U.S. Capitol is Nicholas Grossman. He's a political science professor at the University of Illinois, and he's a senior editor at ARC Digital. Nicholas, what's up?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You wrote a column for ARC Digital called QAnon Woke Up the Real Deep State, and what you argue in that column has really stuck with me in the days since the attempted attack on the U.S. Capitol. In it, you basically lay out an open letter to QAnon adherents and other conspiracy theorists who have spent years fantasizing and cooking up theories about a deep state. And, you know, you make the argument that the deep state kind of is real, but it's not what they think it is. And very quickly, they're going to learn what it really is. Can you kind of walk us through your plea to QAnon believers in case any are maybe perhaps listening now?
Sure. And I would think this also could be, you know, broadly at anybody who, say, theorizes about the deep state or worries about it or uses that term. So the term deep state originally came from and referred to Turkey, 20th century Turkey, where the military was tasked with being the guardian of a secular Turkish democracy that was in line with the vision of Ataturk, of the founder of modern Turkey. And they would have occasionally overthrow an elected leader with a coup if they thought that the elected leader was straying from that vision. So in a way, this was the kind of permanent part of the government that was in a way more powerful than the elected leaders. And you can also apply this to some Soviet states, especially Soviet satellite states. In the more modern American context, you hear a lot of conspiracy theorists, especially QAnon, talking about how the deep state is both more powerful in fighting against elected leaders and is also pervasive in your life, that, you know, it cares about you personally and is, you know, harassing or managing or manipulating you. And that's the part where it goes way too far. But there is something that could fairly be called the deep state, which is that the executive branch is huge. If you include the military, over 4 million people work for it. Without the military, it's about 2.7 million. And all of them, with the exception of about 12 to 1,500 leaders, are not elected or appointed. They are, or so 12 to 1,500 is the appointed officials, plus all the elected officials. That there's also all these other people who work for these agencies. Think, you know, FBI, CIA, NSA. You can also add in, say, IRS or CDC. And all of these agencies are operating according to laws and also regulations that they write themselves. And they hire people themselves according to criteria they come up with themselves. And there's a lot of leeway in their mission. So, for example, the FBI is tasked with investigating federal crimes and threats to national security. And there are some things the law says that they are especially empowered to do, like arrest people. And there are some restrictions on them, like they need warrants. But that is pretty broad. A lot of it's up to interpretation, especially national security threats. And so that means there is these actors that are sort of under elected official control, but not totally. And so I think it is fair to, you know, refer to that perhaps as the deep state. But the part that I was trying to get people to understand in this article, especially, say, QAnon adherents, is that the deep state cares about big national security level issues, that they're worried about terrorism and, say, serial killers, narco traffickers, and especially foreign governments. And that already takes up an immense amount of their time and attention. And so while maybe there are some individuals who have abused their power in a personal way, the deep state as a whole doesn't really care about a lot of the little stuff that people think it cares about. But one thing that it very much does care about is an attack on the United States of America, which is how I would classify the attack on the Capitol. And right. So it's going to react to it in that way.
Right. You mentioned that, you know, the deep state, as it does, you know, sort of legitimately exist, doesn't really care about the individuals. And, you know, for the past 4 years, it's become a fairly common trope, I think, in right-wing media, or at least right-wing social media influencer media, if you would call it that. You know, one of my favorite genres of posts is like the Todd Starnes or Sebastian Gorkas of the world having an issue with their Wi-Fi at home and thinking the deep state is trying to hack their secrets or prevent them from going to Parler.com and posting epic Trump memes or something. But that's not really what, you know, this whole apparatus is designed to do. You mentioned it's focused on these broader national security issues. But, you know, the attack on the U.S. Capitol building is a national security issue nonetheless. So, you know, do you expect that this deep state is now actually going to start paying attention to these different groups that maybe thought, I don't know, their Twitter app was crashing because the deep state was trying to censor their awesome Ben Garrison cartoons?
Well, I still don't think they're going to go around trying to censor, you know, dank memes and awesome cartoons and what have you. But it is very likely, and you can already see signs of this, of turning its eye on these forces that, if anything, I've been trying to get them, and I'm not the only one, to take some of these things more seriously, both QAnon specifically, conspiracy theories more generally, and especially far-right extremists. And trying to take it more seriously as a national security threat after things like the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, the El Paso Walmart shooting, the MAGA bomber of Caesar Sayoc, the guy with the basically printed out a bunch of Trump memes and put them all over his van and sent them to Trump enemies. Especially this earlier in 2020, when there was a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, that the FBI thankfully broke up. But that was, when you look at it, sure looks like a precursor of the Capitol attack in that they plan to kidnap her and then possibly execute her over live stream or, and put it on the internet. And that seems quite a bit like the current plot. So I think they were slow because often it is the ship of state is slow to turn. But when it is pointed at something, it is pretty methodical and relentless. And you can look at the war on terrorism starting after September 11th is a good example of this. That sometimes it even, you know, goes too far where it's overreach. That we can already see, though, in this case, some of these signs with things like the 20,000 National Guards troops that are now protecting D.C. to protect the Capitol building, protect the inauguration. The FBI has a charge. I think at this point it's almost has arrested and DOJ charged almost up to 100 people involved in the Capitol attack. I expect that to grow a lot. Different investigations that are underway. There was also a bulletin put out by a joint effort of Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and the National Counterterrorism Center that warned that far-right domestic extremists, including those connected to conspiracy theories, are the most salient terrorist threat against the United States in the immediate future. That one's also new. And all of this shows the deep state, or, you know, say the national security state, starting to direct its capabilities as what it is now recognizing as a threat to the country.
So I want to ask you and step back and get your opinion for a second, which is that, you know, as somebody who has obviously been paying attention to the threat of political extremism, what happened at the Capitol? Did that surprise you at all? Because for me, it kind of seemed, as cynical as this may sound, like the natural end result of these trends that have been building for years and years.
Yes and no. I mean, I think like you. So when I say no, I didn't see it coming in that I did not specifically predict violence against the Capitol on this date or, you know, a mob attack on the Capitol that, you know, so maybe not that specific act. But I agree with you. I think that this has been building for a while. I think this is a. To a degree, I'm feeling like I have an I told you so moment, which is something that I would have really preferred to be wrong, but where where, you know, and I'd been calling for a while that Trump would try to steal the election if he didn't win, that he was kind of trying to steal it in advance, but would really try to steal it if he didn't win, that I had even broken it down in advance where I did kind of a point by point of this is what he's doing that culminated in trying to get presumably Biden leading mail-in voters thrown out. And so I was kind of up to that point of the plan. And then he, you know, just kept going with it. And I'd also been warning for a while, and I'm not the only one here, but warning for a while about violence from really hardcore Trumpist or QAnon sectors if Trump lost. Because if you think of the mindset of, to them, he's not, say, just a president. He's almost like a messiah. And with all of these fantasies about him fighting this evil cabal that, and he's now going to rescue humanity from, you know, this terrible time period after which all this greatness will flourish. And then all of a sudden he lost and he's about to be out of power. That's just not all the normal disappointment or even the normal fear that somebody might have for their presidential candidate losing. It's kind of next level. And if you really, truly thought that you're on the verge of defeating the evilest evil and then got thwarted, you might react drastically too. And so I was expecting potentially some violence, and I warned of this pre-election of QAnon violence and other kind of conspiracy theorist or pro-Trump kind of far-right extremist violence in the event of the of Trump losing. And I think that has unfortunately been proven right. And that a lot of people, you know, I'm sure you can put yourself on this list too, that got accused of things like being deranged, you know, like Trump derangement syndrome, that clearly those people were not taking the problem seriously enough.
Right. So now that, you know, these more extreme forces that were all brought together by this disinformation and outright conspiracy theories and lies about the integrity of the democratic process. Now that they, you know, this moment has come and gone, they gathered up, organized online, ended up attacking the U.S. Capitol, and now are suffering the fallout, the corrosion of that unity and, you know, a lot of online deplatforming. Something I've been wondering about and talking with others about is where things go from here. Because to what you were just saying, you know, if somebody genuinely and sincerely believes some of the more, especially some of the more deranged lies about the electoral process that were being spread around, you know, these people would think that the government has just been compromised, that, you know, a band of nefarious forces came together and destroyed democracy. You know, I think individuals like you and myself would look at it and say, oh, these, you know, rioters were trying to damage or upend democracy. But, you know, it's kind of strange to think about. But for the genuine believers in that crowd, they were kind of thinking the same thing. And I don't think that is just going to go away when Joe Biden is sworn into office. I think it's going to follow us for some time. What say you?
I think so too, though I might be a little more optimistic about it. And the reason why, so some element of the Trump, I see no reason why he won't just sustain the lie. He always, you know, sustains the lie. And in part, he needs to sustain the lie at this point to keep getting money, if nothing else. And so we'll keep doing it. And that has a kind of stabbed in the back myth quality to it that I think is very dangerous. The conspiracy theories also have showed, QAnon especially, has shown itself very adaptable. There was a period when 8chan got shut down after Christchurch shooting, El Paso shooting, and then the Poway Synagogue shooting in all rapid succession. All of them had been hanging out and getting encouraged on those forums. The servers that were hosting them kicked them off. And during that period, Q couldn't post. And a lot of the followers were starting to express basically depression, like, oh, where is it? We need him to tell us what's next. And then this weird thing happened where a lot of them started reinterpreting past posts. Like, they didn't even need Q anymore. They just kind of kept doing new conspiracy theories. So that, I think, won't go away. But I do think that the government treating it more as a potential terrorist threat and the various big tech companies cutting down on its lines of communication, added with Trump no longer being president, so the fantasy that he is secretly from the White House communicating top-level intelligence to them is – I mean, I'm sure some will still believe it somehow that he's like president in exile or whatever, but that one won't fly as much. And this was also where I tried to the degree I really was talking to QAnon followers, I tried to, try to help them understand that even if they personally think that something wrong happened in the election, the deep state is not going to care. It doesn't matter what you believe. If you commit a crime, especially if you commit a federal crime, if you attack the United States, they're going to react as if you attacked the United States. It doesn't matter if you think you were righteous. Al Qaeda thought they were righteous when they attacked the United States. They thought they were right, and we did not care. So that, I think, all of that, the pressure from them, and where I was saying, recommend that if that's not really what you signed up for, if you don't want the actual deep state to be focused on you, and I don't mean just like one random person on an internet forum, but to be focused on the overall movement, then if that wasn't what you signed up for, now would be a really good time to get out. And I think all of these forces together make it that I am at least cautiously optimistic that this will be less vibrant in the not too distant future.
So what played out on the screens of our televisions and cell phones as we watched along on January 6th was deeply unsettling and upsetting. But in the days since the attack on the Capitol, we've learned new details from different arrest records, from open source research, from folks that have been working online, that things really could have been a lot worse. I'm thinking in particular of the two explosive devices that police were able to contain and remove safely. I'm thinking of the individuals who were photographed with flexi-cuff zip-tie handcuffs in the Capitol. And if, for all the legitimate criticisms and questions that Capitol Police and law enforcement on that day will continue to have to answer for as far as why the Capitol perimeter was breached, I do think that we can kind of count our blessings that it wasn't even worse. When we were talking a little bit in Twitter DMs before you came on, you said something to me that I thought was particularly interesting, which was that the lack of any sort of major counter protest at the on January 6th, you think kind of ended up playing, I don't want to say a net positive, what happened wasn't positive to any degree, but did sort of have a role in making the attack on the Capitol the clear-cut situation that it was. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Sure. So I also wouldn't say, a net positive, but as a so much better than it could have been. So there were multiple ways, both in specifically the moving around the Capitol, where I don't know why you carry plastic cuffs unless you're planning to detain somebody, that there were increasing amount of evidence of what you might call, say, harder core, maybe more dedicated operatives that were in there that we got distracted from because of the big showy kind of, goofy people that were, basically influencers walking around and taking photos and stuff, mm-hmm. that we focused on them first. So it definitely could have been much worse in terms of the actual attack itself, but also in terms of the overall event and the media narrative surrounding it, that by the counter protesters, Antifa or whoever, staying away, it meant that the story that came out of it was overwhelmingly these people attack the government, as opposed to the story that came out of lesser events like, say, events in Portland, Oregon, or if you go back to Charlottesville in 2017, that in those, the part of the story was, look at these people punching each other. Aren't they all crazy? And there was so much also dedicated narrative from right-wing media that was sympathetic to, say, groups like the Proud Boys that would try to highlight this as, no, no, we're the innocent victims, we're the good guys. And there was none of that. The story that came out of it, and which I think is, you know, overwhelming, even among people who, quite a few people who are Trump supporters, is that this was a pro-Trump attack on America. And they beat up cops. They killed one. That, you know, so as opposed to this police versus all of these extremists, you had this was basically, you know, Proud Boys and, I don't know, Oath Keepers and QAnon types and in general MAGA against the state, against the government, against democracy, and against police. And that, you know, also threw off a lot of the Blue Lives Matter stuff, you know, you think from the last year. And it could have instead have been sort of a street brawl and confusing, and people could have muddied the waters. And this is also something where I really hope that they realize, you know, say anybody who would be a counter-protester, would try to get into street fights, realizes this, absorbs this lesson, that this is much worse for their enemies than getting punched in the street, and that they should continue to stay out of it and let the state take care of it. Because the state, the national security state, the deep state, is a tool. It's an institution. It's not necessarily a villain. It's done a lot of terrible things. I won't, you know, I think that's just objective. You know, I wouldn't defend it from that. It's done a lot of terrible things, but it's also done good things and can be pointed in one direction or another. And then it would make more sense to try to point the state at these far-right extremists rather than to continue to think that they should be fighting the far-right extremists themselves.
So I want to push on that idea a little bit, maybe anticipating in ways that some people listening may, you know, think a little bit differently about this. Mm-hmm. An argument that I've heard frequently from different anti-fascist activists or folks on the street I've interviewed at some of these larger street protests is the feeling that, you know, police or the, you know, security apparatus don't have the broader best interest in mind, and that as far as on a community level, they have to show up and act as a line of defense. It sounds like you're making the argument that that, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of cases where law enforcement or national security has failed communities in that sense. But I'm curious, you know, how your perspective might answer that criticism or jive with that criticism. I think we have similar ideas in that respect, so I don't think it necessarily clashes with that idea, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
So first off, this doesn't take away from, you know, any, say, criticisms of, for example, institutionalized racism in policing and the justice system writ large. You know, so that almost, I'd say, separate issue. Mm-hmm. Part of it, when you talk about with the local communities, is one of the things that makes this attack different is that this is a national security issue, that it is a level of involved level of problem and a level of the professionals and the resources that will address it that is not the same as, local cops. That being said, there are, I think, you know, some degree of legitimate concerns. It's just that because it was so clear who did it, and because it was, and I think we're going to learn even more, that an egregious attack that was a near miss from something like, say, Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi being killed on television, that we are so close to that, that the national security state has changed its mind somewhat. There's also positive signs in that the military inspector general, the internal watchdog of the military, announced a probe into military personnel who are sympathetic to white nationalists, white supremacists, and other far-right extremist ideologies.
Right, that's something that people have been calling for years.
Mm-hmm. And this is the sort of thing that spurred it. So I won't claim that something like the state went from bad to now great. In fact, I think that's even the wrong way to think about it, as if it was a person making moral decisions, as opposed mm-hmm. to a giant institution filled with a lot of different people who have a lot of different views and can be used by policymakers, by the public, as a tool in one direction or another.
Yeah, my whole take on it is ultimately, you know, use the tools at your disposal to keep everybody safe. That's the most important thing in my mind, is everything I do with the work that I do and the way that I use my work is all about just making sure that things like we saw on January 6th aren't a regular occurrence, and the movements behind some of the more nefarious elements of it, you know, never see a day in America where they have any sort of major political power.
Yeah, so just a way where you said, I think it is a really good way to think about it, of the degree to which, so the if the state is now pointed at these people, if people have been advocating, you have to go through the military and try to go through police departments and look for white supremacists, you know, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, if they're actually doing it, if they're actually starting to head in that direction, and also they will, Democrats having about to have control of all the major parts of government, or at least, sorry, elected government, will also help with this, because the president and congressional committees have a lot of leverage over the deep state. They can fire, the president can fire people, Congress can subpoena anybody or cut off their budgets. And so they have that degree of oversight. And if you've been trying to get them to start taking this problem seriously, don't give them an excuse not to. That, you know, encourage them to do so, even if it maybe, say, makes you a little uncomfortable, while also, I think, being careful not to have overreach. So I, for example, am a pretty strong opponent of some ideas floated about a new domestic terrorism law, about where the president could designate a group as a domestic terrorist organization, kind of like can do as a foreign terrorist organization, which unlocks new powers like freezing asset, financial assets, or nearly unlimited surveillance. And we have a lot of tools, a lot of law enforcement, national security, intelligence tools to go after domestic extremists now. We don't need this kind of additional power. And so I really caution people against, when you think of giving the president new powers, think of it not as a president, not necessarily just as a president you like doing it for reasons you like, but also as a president you don't like doing it for reasons you don't like. And so you could think of somebody like Trump, with the power to actually designate formally a domestic terrorist group, could have easily said that Black Lives Matter, all of it, are domestic terrorists. And that would have been something in the president's power. So I wouldn't want to give the president new powers to do that, but I would want to take the existing capacity of the federal government and point it at this problem.
Right. That's something I've been really trying to stress, which is that the mechanisms to, you know, protect the United States from these different kind of threats already exist. And there's already a good track record for using them. The national security apparatus just has to have the will and the reason and justification to use those mechanisms in that way. And it seems like this attack on the Capitol, even though many of the people who participated and cheered it on in the immediate days seemed to think it was, you know, the best thing that they had ever done, I think ultimately, you know, ended up being kind of a suicide mission for a lot of these extremist movements.
In a way, yeah. A lot of them are going to find that the activity that they enjoyed just kind of fantasizing with people online has now crossed the line. And, you know, the line that we have to keep our society together is we solve our problems, our differences nonviolently through mechanisms like elections and courts and arguments and protests. And obviously that doesn't always work out well and there are problems with it, but it is much better than we try to solve our problems when all those other nonviolent measures don't go ways we want, then we resort to violence. And that is just over the line. And even the people who found that they were, I don't know, kind of, you know, doofuses, just sort of walking around the Capitol and, you know, smiling or taking photos, that even if they didn't fully understand it, they were part of an attack on America. They were at absolute minimum cover for some much more hardcore people who had violence in mind. Like, you know, the people who planted those bombs, or the people with the plastic cuffs, or Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley's chief of staff said that the panic button that's in their office had been ripped out and they didn't know why. So they went to use it, and she had used it before in the past. They went to use it as the attack was going on and it wasn't there. And that is a very kind of strange, concerning thing that I don't want to get ahead of ourselves and say exactly, you know, speculate about what it would be, but it's very serious and the sort of thing that would have to be looked into. And I'm pretty confident that we're going to see a lot of those investigations. It might be slow and methodical. That's kind of the way the government works. But I would expect, for example, a big congressional investigation, something kind of like a 9/11 commission report, but for this. And that would include looking into basically everything. And we already see the FBI starting to look into these little criminal events, things like, you know, unauthorized entry is what they're starting to charge people with. And that will likely build and build perhaps to something like, say, seditious conspiracy.
Right. I think the more that we learn as time goes on, the more we'll understand just how dire that situation was. So I've been talking to Nicholas Grossman, political science professor at the University of Illinois and senior editor at ARC Digital, one of my favorite opinion shops on the internet. So huge props there. Nicholas, this is Shitpost, so I have one more question for you. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now? There's a lot of terrible, awful stuff on the internet. The term doom scrolling is popular. What's your favorite thing that you go online and enjoy?
So most of what I end up doing online is that terrible, awful stuff. I mean, this is something about I've been studying terrorism for this point 20 years about. So I spend a lot of time with that. But on the non-awful stuff, I think probably my favorite at the moment is to hear people arguing or making fun of Tenet, of the movie Tenet, which I like Christopher Nolan. I saw it. I tend to like time travel movies. It's one of those where I've actually watched it 3 times, even though I never really liked it that much. I liked it. So I kind of liked it, but I had no idea what was going on the first time. Then I thought about it and liked it more. Then I watched it a second time and liked it quite a bit. Then I watched it a third time and think it's actually kind of bad. But the way people argue about it, where in some cases, either just like making fun of it, of I don't understand it, or someone should have at some point told Christopher Nolan no, or the ways that, you know, the time travel actually does kind of line up as long as you don't maybe think about it too hard, which is how every time travel story goes. The time travel where they reverse time is just really cool, really awesome filmmaking. But I've come around to the idea that the issue with the movie was it should have been more convoluted, that it wasn't convoluted enough, that for those who've seen it, it's like sort of for a while almost seems like a Bond type spy thriller. And that part I don't think works nearly as well as when around halfway through it just goes totally bonkers. And if you are not okay with a, really just you're not going to have any idea what's going on type of movie, at least the first time you see it, you probably will not like it. My wife hated it. But when I watched it a second time, I liked it. But so I've enjoyed people making fun of Tenet.
So your official position on Tenet is if you're going to make it confusing, just go all the way?
Yeah, go all the way and don't half-ass the time travel thing. So, if you're actually going to make a time travel movie and just jump into that right away, as opposed to trying to make like an hour of slick spy action thriller that then kind of turns into a time travel movie. Yeah, just go totally insane. I would have liked to see a version of that movie that was totally nuts and didn't even try a tiny bit to make sense.
So, Nicholas, if people want to argue with you about time travel or, I don't know, read the things that you write, where can they find you?
So I'm ARC Digital, and thank you for the kind words about the site. So where I'm one of the people that run it, and I write there most frequently. And also I'm on Twitter. I'm on Twitter a lot, especially lately, which is at ngrossman81.
That was my conversation with Nicholas Grossman. Please check out his work. He is always writing thoughtful stuff for ARC Digital, which is one of my favorite opinion pages on the internet, even when I find things on there I disagree with. And that concludes our two-part series on the attack on the U.S. Capitol building. I'm sure in the days, weeks, and months to come, we will continue to learn more and more about how bad things really could have been. And we'll follow all the developments here and keep you in touch with what you need to know. My name's Jared Holt, and for this week, I'm signing off. Take care.